Pete Buttigieg drops out. The House weighs in on Curtis Hill's qualifications. Plus, Super Tuesday anoints a new frontrunner and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 6th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg dropped out of the presidential race. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Anna Caroline Caruso reports a few hundred supporters gathered in South Bend Sunday night for the announcement.
In his speech, Buttigieg said he doesn't want to further divide the Democratic Party and hurt the chances of a Democratic nominee defeating President Donald Trump.
And we have a responsibility to consider the effect of remaining in this race any further. Our goal has always been to help unify Americans to defeat Donald Trump and to win the era for our values.
Many supporters were surprised and saddened by the news, but say they will support whoever wins the Democratic nomination.
Are you surprised by Buttigieg's exit from the race now? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Before we get to Pete Buttigieg, I want to just say we learned today that Indiana has its first positive case of the coronavirus. It's an isolated case for now, but state health officials say we do expect more. They do urge people not to panic and say you should just follow the normal precautions, which is wash your hands thoroughly with soap, cover your mouth when you cough or sneeze, try to avoid shaking hands with people for a little while. Do the elbow bump, as Eric Holcomb said. And if you are concerned that you might have it, call your doctor or healthcare provider first so they can appropriately deal with it. Now, turning to Pete Buttigieg, Mike O'Brien, are you surprised by how sudden this was?
Of all the decisions, tactical decisions that Pete Buttigieg has made in this race, this is the best one. And I don't think, I don't mean that in a negative way. He made a lot of really impressive political decisions over the course of years now. Since
you would have to if you were the mayor of South Bend
and became a top tier, right? Yeah. That's exactly what I mean. What normally happens, what we saw play out this week with Elizabeth Warren and others, is that they waited too long. The writing was clearly on the wall coming in the Super Tuesday. Who was going to Joe Biden obviously overperformed what people thought he was going to, but no one really believed that it wasn't just between Sanders and Biden. And so by getting out ahead of time, the timing was perfect because that's a transaction at that point. You're trying to turn in whatever leverage you have left at the maximum point at the best time. When's your value really the highest? And it was 48 hours before when he could clearly see he wasn't going to perform well on Super Tuesday and was going to have to make a decision either on Tuesday night or Wednesday or Thursday later in the week. And it mattered a lot that he did it when he did. Probably to Joe Biden, which will come back and really help him if there's some opportunity in the future for him.
Yeah, was this the smart strategic move from Pete Buttigieg?
There's no question about it. There was no question about it. I mean, he's shown himself to be remarkably intelligent and well-informed and articulate all through this process, but he did himself a lot of good by doing it when he did it and how he did it. He was masterful, I thought, in that speech that he gave that was carried in its entirety on CNN. And on top of that, he's not only done himself proud, and he's not only in line for future consideration for any number of different things, but he's done the state proud. We've gone from a homophobic backwater that wants to discriminate against gays to having a gay be the spokesperson for the state. And I think he's done a great deal for the reputation of Indiana in addition to his own reputation. So he has got a lot to be proud of.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the state of the Democratic race a little later in the show. So for right now, Nikki Kelly, a lot of people are asking this question, which is, what's next for Pete Buttigieg?
I think he should take some time and really, figure out. He's got a world of possibilities. And obviously, if a Democrat would win in November, he's looking at some sort of top tier position in the administration, I would say easily. Whether he will want to wait for that and kind of feel things out for a couple months probably, but I know a lot of people are kind of wanting him to find a way to serve back here in Indiana, and so maybe he would look at a future governor run. I just think he can pretty much take his pick.
There are people who are calling out for that, for him to turn to his home state and find something here to do, but quite frankly, given what statewide races are coming up in the next several years and who currently occupies those seats, Senate and governor, is that really a good path forward for Pete Buttigieg?
Well, I don't think it's in keeping with what he has signaled in recent years. Yes, he was the mayor of a mid-sized city in Indiana, but look at what he has actually, the jobs he has sought in the past couple of years. He ran very vigorously for national party chair for the Democratic Central Committee, or the National Committee. Tom Perez actually won, but Buttigieg made a lot of...
got his name out there.
Got his name out there and won a lot of admirers during that process. And then, of course, he did the same thing again here. You know, people saying, who's this upstart? Who's this crazy young mayor from a place we may not have heard of if we're not from Indiana and we're not a Notre Dame fan? And yet, look what he did. So I think Nikki is exactly right. Whether he wants to do commentary or analysis for a network, whether he wants to, as Andrew Yang is, you know, he signed up with...
He's doing a good job.
He is doing a good job. Whether he wants to do that, whether he wants to run a nonprofit, whether he wants to
pay off his student loans,
get a cabinet position. I mean, the skill set he has would lend itself to any number of cabinet positions, it seems to me. So I don't think he'll be filing for unemployment benefits anytime soon with the state of Indiana.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, who will be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020? Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, or theoretically someone else. Last week's question, is Vice President Mike Pence the right choice to lead the U.S. response to coronavirus? 70% of you say yes, 30% of you say no. Actually, we do have that backwards. It's 30%. 30% say yes, 70% say no. Yeah, that did surprise those of us here around the table. If you'd like to take part in the poll, and we promise to report them correctly next time, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Curtis Hill would be forced to step down as Attorney General if his license was suspended for at least a month under an amendment passed by the House this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports that follows a disciplinary hearing officer's recommendation last month of a 60-day suspension.
The amendment alters the qualifications and says if the officeholder's license is suspended for 30 or more days, they forfeit their position with a replacement named by the governor. Current law only requires the Attorney General to have a law license and live in Indiana. Republican Representative Tim Wesko says his amendment is a matter of good policy. Is it acceptable for the AG to hold a suspended law license?
I propose to you that aside from all present circumstances, the answer is no. It is not acceptable.
Attorney General Curtis Hill is accused of groping four women at a party in March 2018. Ultimately, Indiana Supreme Court justices will decide if Hill faces any punishment stemming from those allegations.
Ann Delaney, a member of the House Democratic Caucus, who I believe you're familiar with, called this on the floor impeachment in disguise. Is that what it is?
Well, I thought that was one of Ed's best speeches, actually. Three words? It's pretty good. It actually is. And what really bothers me about this is that 2 years ago, the House had the opportunity to act, to say that conduct where he molests three employees of the legislature and one elected official is not acceptable. And they didn't do it. So they let him stay as Attorney General despite the fact that he molested four women for 2 years, during which time he tried to kick 300,000 Hoosiers off medical coverage and do other assorted things that were bad for the state of Indiana. And now instead of saying, okay, you know, if you've done this conduct, you shouldn't be Attorney General, they're saying if you get suspended for more than 30 days. That way they can go back to their right wing and say, well, we didn't find that conduct to be acceptable or unacceptable. You see, it's just that the Supreme Court's acting. If you were the Supreme Court, first of all, they're not on the timetable the legislature wants, okay? So the briefs aren't even due to May 1. And then you have your convention June 15th. The Republicans must be scared that he's going to be nominated again, or they wouldn't be doing this at this late date. So what you've got here is a Supreme Court that wants, do they want to get themselves in the middle of a political fight right now? Maybe they want to just simply take the approach that the Senate Republicans took in the impeachment trial. Let the voters decide and not make a decision at least till after the convention.
I'm curious about something she just said. Does this send a signal that at least Republican lawmakers are worried that Curtis Hill is going to get renominated?
I don't think that's part of this. I think they never contemplated having to clarify this because it wasn't clear that it wasn't clear, right? I mean, this part of the law, it wasn't crystal clear that whatever the Supreme Court decides on a suspension, whether they uphold the disciplinary commission's recommendation or not, there needs to be clear guidance in the future. Now, look, I mean, I know Democrats wanted us to inflict as much harm as humanly possible on ourselves politically and how this was handled. But, I mean, look, the reality is, yes, you had this situation occur. You had all legislative leaders and the governor call on Hill to resign. The prosecutor chose not to bring charges. The civil suit was thrown out. And so it isn't crystal clear that rises to the level of impeachment. It is obvious, and it was obvious to legislators and the governor in this move to clarify the law in the event that 60-day suspension
That was thrown out of federal court only because of a federal statute. That doesn't mean that the case didn't have any merit.
It does.
Okay?
The judge's ruling, which came down this week, did leave it open that it could continue
right.
in state court.
I don't disagree with you. What I'm saying is that the Supreme Court comes out and says we're upholding the 60-day suspension, and then you point to the law, and it's not clear that he actually has to vacate that office, and that needed to be fixed. And that's what this was about.
Except
that,
so
here's the thing I'm curious about, which is reporters have been asking this question for 2 years now about certainly a year since the disciplinary complaint came out. What would happen if his law license were suspended? Because we could read the statute as much as anybody else.
Really?
And theoretically anyway, better than some lawmakers, I think. We asked Republican leaders this question, and they all said, we don't know what happens, but they expressed hesitance about wanting to do anything because of how political it would seem. And yet they did it anyway all of a sudden.
Was it just a matter of,
we can't avoid this any longer?
A little bit. I think the technical term here is, it's a twofer. Yes, they needed to address the question, the elephant in the room. What happens if, in fact, this penalty that's been recommended is upheld and affirmed by the Supreme Court? Because the Supreme Court, I can see, I'm not sure what they would do. They basically have to do what judges say they hate to do, which is
legislate from the bench.
Which is legislate from the bench, because it's not a matter, as John Roberts would say, of calling balls and strikes, because we can see from the statute there's just no pitch call. I mean, it's just a blank slate. So I think it was incumbent on lawmakers to provide guidance. I mean, that is probably the role of the General Assembly. But why I call it a twofer is, of course, it has the bonus, if you will, if in fact you're somebody like, for instance, the governor who wants to see him gone, so he doesn't have to stand up there at the stage at the convention and do the obligatory, you know, grip and grin shot, hey, we're going to win. It's a twofer.
The author of the amendment, Representative Tim Wesko, who was the author of the underlying bill and the House Elections Committee chair, is a vocal supporter of John Westerkamp, who's running against Curtis Hill for the Republican nomination. Do you think 1 + 1 = 2 in that case, or does those two?
I don't actually think so. I think he was just the obvious person to carry the language, and they waited as long as they could. They were hoping the Supreme Court would bail him out and tell him. I honestly don't think anyone had really envisioned a suspension until the hearing officer came out with the recommendation, and then everyone sort of freaked
now we have
out.
To deal with those.
And I will point out to one other thing that is interesting in that language. We've all talked about how he would lose his post. But it also would stop him from running again. It says anyone who has been suspended for 30 days in the last 5 years would not be able to be a candidate. That specifically gets at him not being a convention candidate.
Or if it happens after the convention,
they can immediately toss
him
out
from the ballot and they replace him on the
ballot.
You
know, you can risk suspension of your license for failing to return your client's phone calls, okay? Mm-hmm. Groping women and then lying about it, and then using state resources to protect yourself seems to me definite grounds for suspension. They knew it was coming. They just wanted to be able to do it at the last possible second and get away with it. That's what they wanted.
Well, it certainly prevents anybody from, say, testifying in a public hearing about said language. Democrats have a new frontrunner for the presidential nomination, at least by delegate count, after 14 states voted this week on Super Tuesday. Former Vice President Joe Biden, whose campaign was left for dead by some pundits just a few weeks ago, won 10 of the Super Tuesday states, including Texas, Massachusetts, and a big win in Virginia. Senator Bernie Sanders won the biggest prize of the night, California, though Biden will pick up delegates there, just as Sanders did in Texas. Leading into the primaries this week, Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar dropped out, endorsing Biden. In the wake of the results, Mike Bloomberg ended his bid, also endorsing the former VP. Elizabeth Warren suspended her campaign Thursday, though she hasn't yet endorsed one of the remaining candidates. Nikki Kelly, at this rate, will Indiana's May 5th primary be a competitive one?
Probably not. I mean, I think, 41 other states vote before we do, so the likelihood is probably not. I mean, we've gotten a few times in 2008 with President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and then in 2016 with both races. So it's not out of the question, but I think the way everyone is coalescing and, you know, I think the next couple, you know, key states are going to show a lot of a difference in where people are going for Biden or Bernie.
John Juanis, it's raised the question because of how quickly things have changed in this race. Should Indiana move up at least its presidential primary to matter a little more? We don't matter as much, and we haven't mattered in a while other than 2008 in the general election. So should we at least get to be more involved in the primary?
Sure, if you're a political junkie, as I think we all fall into that classification. To the extent that it's good for economic development, if it is a viable race and you do have media coverage, if you do have staff work being done here, at the margins at least, it's beneficial. It's good for the state coffers. But this is a return to what I remember. You know, back, what we've seen the last few cycles was the aberration for any number of circumstances. But, you know, for years the joke was, you know, you might get the next-door neighbor of a second cousin of the spouse of a candidate. That's the best sort of stand-in you'd get in Indiana in a presidential year, because it's inconsequential. And I think we're heading back to normal.
Are you surprised by how fast this turned around?
I am a little bit. I mean, we wouldn't be talking about, a week ago, we wouldn't have maybe thought we were going to be talking about, do we move the primary up to make this more competitive? Because it appeared to be competitive, right? Yeah. And it appeared to be competitive. We were talking about a contested convention and a broker convention and all of that. So, I mean, we'll see. There's what do you need? You need 1,991 in the Democratic convention to get the nomination. We got 2,004 between here and our primary that are eligible. It's consolidating pretty quick. I mean, I think the New York Times said today that Obama's been directing major donors towards Biden. So it seems like they're kind of releasing everybody to go get behind Biden against Bernie.
We asked this in the poll question earlier in the show, so we'll see what the viewers and listeners have to say. But in your view, is Joe Biden the Democratic nominee?
I think he is. And I think Michigan will probably make certain the consolidation continues quickly. I mean, I know that Bernie Sanders was on Rachel Maddow last night talking about the rules again, but, you know, the rules have been changed twice in response to Bernie Sanders. He was allowed to run as a Democrat in the first place in 2016 when he wasn't a Democrat, and then they changed the superdelegate rules to favor him. They're off the first ballot now. Now he wants a third change, okay? I mean, either he wins or he doesn't, and if he doesn't, it's because of him. It's not because the deck was stacked against him this time.
But now we'll never get to know if Pete Buttigieg could have carried his home state.
That's true. At least not this
time.
Well,
that's true. You don't know that yet. I mean, you never get to know. He may be back as the number one in another couple of cycles.
Well, a measure to restrict local governments from creating regulations on landlords passed out of the Indiana House this week, despite pushback from several hundred housing, legal, and other organizations. The vote comes after Indianapolis passed an ordinance recently to protect tenants' rights. The Senate bill includes a provision that would restrict local governments from making similar regulations governing tenant-landlord relationships without approval from the state legislature. Bloomington Representative Matt Pierce says the language in the bill will affect many communities, including his own.
And I think you're going to find that if you have communities with even non-controversial ordinances related to landlord-tenant relationships, they're going to get challenged in court if this becomes law.
Indianapolis, South Bend, and Fort Wayne have some of the highest rates of eviction among larger cities in the country, according to a study from the Eviction Lab out of Princeton University. John Schwannis, is this the Indiana General Assembly City County Council?
I think it's...
Because this is not an isolated case.
No, it's hardly an isolated case. If you look back, say, to, I think, really picked up steam around 2011, and you started seeing one or two preemption fights every session, although they weren't really, in many cases, fights. It was basically a slam dunk. So you had everything from municipalities not being allowed to have firearms restrictions that went beyond
plastic bags in Bloomington.
Yeah, Bloomington, yeah. Heaven forbid, they banned the grocery. That, yeah, but and actually, it's not even the first for landlord. You had situations where landlord registries were off the table. You had situations where there were certain types of measures that had been put in place to promote affordable housing and prevent discrimination. A lot of these Bloomington, I'm just joking, whatever Bloomington City Council apparently wants to do, that seems inherently bad.
Or any city controlled by Democrats.
Let me ask this. So is this somewhat a symptom of, because he said it started picking up around 2011. That also coincides with Republican majorities and then supermajorities in both chambers. Is that what we see here? Is Republicans don't like something that Democrats do in a city and they're going to take it over?
Oh,
is it that simple?
Clearly. I mean, as soon as a city starts looking at something that, you know, opponents don't like, they come and they say, oh, well, we have the numbers here. We don't have them in the city, but we have the numbers at the General Assembly. I don't know whether this bill is good or bad for landlords or tenants. I'm sure anything is an improvement, but the process it's taking is really disheartening. You know, to throw this major thing that preempts every other community in the state from dealing with an issue at their local level at the last minute, no public testimony, even in a conference committee, they wouldn't allow public testimony until they were forced to listen to two people. So the way it's been handled has not been good.
Let's talk a little bit about the bill in question, because it doesn't just relate to Indianapolis, though it's certainly aimed at Indianapolis this time. Arguments for the bill say we shouldn't have a hodgepodge of regulations across the state. It should be one size fits all. Is that wrong?
That's always the argument, every time they want to usurp local power. And I thought the Republicans were the ones who say that the government closest to the people is the government that functions the best. You know, you've got situations here where the landlord, the large landlords and out-of-state landlords, control the General Assembly. This is the problem with the supermajority. They can do what they're doing. They can drop it in at the last minute with no discussion. Indiana and the major cities in Indiana have among the highest eviction rates in the country, And that's because we're not doing anything to protect renters. This was a pretty modest attempt to give them some protections, and the Republicans, either because they're funded or because they're part of the landlord establishment, are going to shut it down in a back room with no public testimony, and shame on them.
Local control is always good when you want it to be good and bad when you want it to be bad, and that's true for both parties.
Yeah.
But what's the case here?
It's all a matter of perspective, right, on what's good and bad. I'm a local control guy. I read this proposal because I wasn't really up on it when the amendment hit, and I just kind of knew the politics of it. I don't get it. Like, the most offensive thing, the most aggressive thing, I guess, and that is offensive to people who are opposed to it, is that you wouldn't be able to be evicted if you reported that your heat was out or there was a gas leak. That doesn't seem extreme.
How dare they?
Maybe I don't get it, but I don't think I'm violating any conservative principle by supporting something like that.
I'm sure you'll hear about it if you have.
But like, you know, I can't believe, it's hard for me to believe that this is a totally partisan vote, and it's not a partisan issue. I mean, the issue of local control should be a partisan issue in favor of Republicans, but we have these examples. Now, it's not unfair in the city of Indianapolis' example, because they are created by statute, because so many things, and they always have issues in front of the legislature, because their unique tax structure, their governance structure is all in-state statute, right? So when it needs to be changed, you have to go to the legislature and do it. And you have lawmakers who are...
This is a statewide thing.
Yes,
it's
aimed at Indianapolis, but it's not about Indianapolis.
No, but the comment was made on the outset that here we go again, the legislature regulating the city of Indianapolis. But they have to.
They
already
left enthusiastic
after a half a century.
To the benefit of their contributors.
I get it.
Finally, the House honored retiring Representative Pat Bauer this week, the longest-serving lawmaker in Indiana history. The full resolution gave members plenty of chances to share their favorite stories about Bauer and his 50-year State House career. So, Ann Delaney, I'm betting you have a favorite Pat Bauer story.
You know,
which
Pat,
one can you tell us
Pat,
on air?
Yeah, there are a couple I couldn't tell you online. But there are what's interesting about Pat is 50 years in the legislature, he managed to irritate governors of both parties all the way along the line. And one particular time, he and Evan Bayh were locked in a battle over some piece of legislation. I forget what it even was. And the governor was on the phone with him and using language that you wouldn't expect a governor to use, nor would you expect Evan Bayh to use. So I was sent upstairs to kind of smooth things over after the fact. And the only thing Pat could keep saying is, do you know what word he used? Do you know what word he used in that conversation? I said, yes, and it's not the first time I've heard it, Pat. He was shocked.
Nikki Kelly, do you have a favorite Pat Bauer
story? Oh, absolutely. I will never, ever forget Pat Bauer standing at the front of the rostrum holding up video of Tom Kronkowski trying to remote vote from South Bend to pass a full-day kindergarten bill.
Which today
it
would be
stunning.
Today, but to the public, it wouldn't seem like that big of a deal.
He was just ahead of his time, apparently.
Right. He Skyped him in.
All right. He was an elected official from South Bend before it became a national trend to do so.
That's true.
Cool.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.